Home Where Thou Art Loved the Best, accompanied by Mrs. Horrocks on an upright piano whose past was more glorious than its present. The girls were then invited to ask the visitor questions, but only white misses raised their hands.
Sir, do you know George Washington?
Alas, no.
How many horses pull your carriage?
My father-in-law keeps four, but I prefer to ride a single mount. The littlest asked of me,
Do ants get headaches?
Had her classmates' titters not reduced my interrogator to tears, I should be standing there pondering this question still. I told the students to live by the Bible and obey their elders, then took my leave. Mrs. Horrocks told me departees were once presented with a garland of plumeria, but the mission elders deemed garlands immoral. If we allow garlands today, it will be dancing tomorrow. If there is dancing tomorrow... She shuddered. 'Tis a pity. By noon, the men had loaded the cargo, and the prophetess was kedging out of the bay against unfavorable winds. Henry and I have retired to the mess room to avoid the spray and oaths. My friend is composing an epic in Byronic stanzas entitled True History of Atua, Last Moriori, and interrupts my journal writing to ask what rhymes with what. Streams of blood? Themes of mud? Robin Hood? I recall the crimes Mr. Melville imputes to Pacific missionaries in his recent account of the Typee. As with cooks, doctors, notaries, clergymen, captains, and kings, might evangelists also not be some good, some bad? Maybe the Indians of the societies and the Chathams would be happiest undiscovered. But to say so is to cry for the moon. Should we not applaud Mr. Horrocks's and his brethren's efforts to assist the Indians climb up civilization's ladder? Is not ascent their sole salvation? I know not the answer, nor whence flew the surety of my younger years. During my night at the Horrocks's parsonage, a burglar broke into my coffin, and when the reprobate could not locate my Jackwood trunks key, I wear it around my neck, he attempted to force the lock. Had he succeeded, Mr. Busby's deeds and documents would now be fodder for seahorses. How I wish our captain was cut from trustworthy Captain Beale's cloth. I dare not give Captain Molyneux custody of my valuables, and Henry warned me against stirring the hornet's nest by raising the attempted crime with Mr. Boerhaafer, lest an investigation spur every thief aboard to try his luck whenever my back is turned. I suppose he is right. Monday, the 16th of December. Today at noon the sun was vertical, and that customary humbuggery known as crossing the line was let loose, by which virgins, those crewmen crossing the equator for the first time, endure various hazings and duckings as thought fit by those tars conducting ceremonies. The sensible Captain Beale did not waste time on this during my Australia-bound voyage, but the seamen of the Prophetess were not to be denied their fun. I considered all notions of fun to be an anathema to Mr. Boerhaafer, until I saw what cruelties these amusements entailed. Finbar warned us the two virgins were Raphael and Bentnail. The latter has been at sea for 2 years, but sailed only the Sydney-Cape Town run. During the dog watch, the men slung an awning over the foredeck and assembled around the capstan, where King Neptune, Pocock, dressed in absurd robe with a squilgy wig, was holding court. The virgins were tied to the catheads like a pair of St. Sebastians.
"Sawbone and Mr. Quillcock," cried Pocock upon seeing Henry and me. "Art thou come to rescue our virgin sisters from my scab-dragon?"
Pocock danced with a marlin spike in a vulgar fashion, and the seamen clapped with licorice laughter. Henry, laughing, retorted that he preferred his virgins without beards. Pocock's riposte on maidens' beards is too obscene to record.
His barnacled majesty turned back to his victims. Bent Nail of Cape Town, Riff the Raff of Convict Town, be you ready to enter the Order of the Sons of Neptune? Raphael, his boyish spirits restored in part by the antics, responded with a brisk, Aye, your lordship. Bent Nail gave a surly nod. Neptune roared, Nay! Not till we shave those damned scales off, you soggerers. Bring me the shaving cream. Torgny hurried up with a pail of tar, which he applied to the prisoners' faces with a brush. Next, Guernsey appeared, dressed as Queen Amphitrite, and removed the tar with a razor. The Cape Man howled curses, which caused much merriment and not a few slips of the razor. Raphael had the sound sense to bear his ordeal in silence. Better, better, growled Neptune, before yelling, Blindfold them both and show young Riff into my courtroom. This courtroom was a barrel of salt water into which Raphael was plunged head first while the men chanted to 20, after which Neptune commanded his courtiers to fish out my newest citizen. His blindfold was removed and the boy leant against the bulwarks to recover from his hazing. Bent Nail acquiesced less willingly, yelling, Unhand me, you sons of witches! King Neptune rolled his eyes in horror. That stinking mouth needs 40 o' the best in the brine, boys, or me eyes ain't mates. On the count of 40, the Afrikaner was raised, baying, I'll kill every last one of you sons of sows. I swear I will, I... To general hilarity, he was submerged for another 40. When Neptune declared his sentence served, he could do nothing but choke and retch feebly. Mr. Boerhaave now ended the skylarking, and the newest sons of Neptune cleaned their faces with oakum and a bar of toilet soap. Finbar was still chuckling at dinner. Cruelty has never made me smile. Wednesday, the 18th of December. Scaly seas. Barely a breath of wind. Thermometer remains about 90 degrees. The crew have washed their hammocks and triced them up to dry. My headaches commence earlier daily, and Henry has once more increased my dosage of vermicide. I pray his supply will not be depleted ere we drop anchor in Ohuai, for the pain unameliorated would shatter my skull. Elsewhere my doctor is kept busy by much erysipelas and bilious cholera on the prophetess. This afternoon's fitful siesta was cut short by clamor, so I went on deck and there found a young shark being baited and hoisted aboard. It writhed in its own brilliant ruby juices for a considerable time before Guernsey declared it well and truly dead. Its mouth and eyes called to mind Tilda's mother. Finbar butchered its carcass on deck and could not altogether ruin its succulence in his galley. A woody, scrawed fish. The more superstitious sailors spurned this treat, reasoning sharks are known to eat men, thus to eat shark flesh is cannibalism by proxy. Mr. Sykes spent a profitable afternoon making sandpaper from the hide of the great fish. Friday, the 20th of December. Can it be that the cockroaches grow fat on me as I sleep? This morning one woke me by crawling over my face and attempting to feed from my nostril. Truly, it was 6 inches long. I was possessed of a violent urge to kill the giant bug, but in my cramped, gloomy cabin it had the advantage. I complained to Finbar, who urged me to pay $1 for a specially trained roach rat. Later, doubtless, he will want to sell me a rat cat to subdue the roach rat. Then I will need a cat hound, and who knows where it will all end. Sunday, the 22nd of December. Hot. So hot. I melt and itch and blister. This morn I awoke to the laments of fallen angels.
I listened in my coffin as moments unfolded into minutes, wondering what new devilry my worm was working, until I made out a booming cry from above. "There she blows!" I uncovered my porthole, but the hour was too dim to see clearly, so despite my weakness, I forced myself up the companionway.
"There, sir, there!"
Raphael steadied me by my waist with one hand as he pointed with the other. I gripped the handrail tight, for my legs are unsteady now. The boy kept pointing.
"There. Ain't they a marvel, sir?"
By the crepuscular light I beheld a spume, only 30 feet from the starboard prow.
"Part of six," shouted Artua from aloft.
I heard the cetaceans breathing, then felt the droplets of spume shower upon us. I agreed with the boy, they make a sublime sight indeed. One heaved itself up, down, and beneath the waves. The flukes of the fish stood in silhouette against the rose-licked east.
"More's the pity we ain't a spouter," I says, commented Newfie.
"Must be 100 barrels of spermaceti in the big un alone," Pocock snapped.
"Not I. I shipped on a spouter once. The captain was the blackest brute you've ever seen. Them 3 years make prophetess seem a Sunday pleasure punt."
I am back in my coffin, resting. We are passing through a great nursery of humpbacks. The cry, "There she blows," is heard so often that none now bother to watch. My lips are baked and peeled. The color of monotony is blue. Christmas Eve. A gale and heavy seas and ship rolling much. My finger is so swollen, Henry had to cut off my wedding band lest it prevent circulation and cause the onset of dropsy. Losing this symbol of my union with Tilda depressed my spirits beyond all measure. Henry berates me for being a silly puffin and insists my wife would set my health above a fortnight without a metal loop. The band is in my doctor's safekeeping, for he knows a Spanish goldsmith in Honolulu who will repair it for a reasonable price. Christmas Day. Long swells left by yesterday's gale. At dawn, the waves looked like mountain ranges tipped with gold as sunbeams slanted low under burgundy clouds. I rallied all my strength to reach the mess room where Mr. Sykes and Mr. Green had accepted Henry's and my invitation to our private Christmas meal. Finbar served a less noxious dinner than is his wont, of lobscouse, salt beef, cabbage, yam, and onion, so I was able to stomach most of it until later. The plum duff had never seen a plum. Captain Molyneux sent word to Mr. Green that the men's grog ration was doubled, so by the afternoon watch the seamen were flown. A regular Saturnalia. A quantity of small beer was poured down a luckless Diana monkey who capped its crapulous mummery by jumping overboard. I retired to Henry's cabin, and together we read the second chapter of Matthew. The dinner wrought havoc on my digestion and necessitated frequent visits to the head. On my last visit, Raphael was waiting outside. I apologized for delaying him, but the boy said no, he had contrived this meeting. He confessed he was troubled and posed me this question. "God lets you in, doesn't he? If you're sorry. No matter what you do, he don't send you to, you know." Here the prentice mumbled, "Hell." I own my mind was more on digestion than on theology, and I blurted out that Raphael could hardly have notched up a mortal portfolio of sin in his few years. The storm lantern swung, and I saw misery distort my young brave's face. Regretting my levity, I affirmed the Almighty's mercy is indeed infinite, that joy shall be in heaven over one sinner that repenteth, more than over 99 just persons which need no repentance. Did Raphael wish to confide in me, I asked, be it as a friend, or a fellow orphan, or a relative stranger? I told him I had noticed how downcast he seemed of late and lamented how altered was that blithe boy who had stepped aboard in Sydney, so eager to see the wide world. Ere he framed his reply, however, an attack of laxity obliged me to return to the head. When I emerged, Raphael was gone. I shall not press the matter. The boy knows where he can find me. Later. Seven bells of the first watch were just smote. My worm pains my head as if the clapper strikes my skull. Do ants get headaches? I gladly should be turned into an ant to be freed from these agonies. How Henry and others sleep through this din of debauchery and blasphemous caroling, I know not, but keenly I envy them. I snuffed some vermicide, but it no longer brings elation. It merely helps me feel halfway ordinary. Then I took a turn about the decks, but the Star of David was obscured by thick clouds. A few sober shouts aloft, Atua's among them, and Mr. Green at the wheel assured me that not all the crew were 16 sheets to the wind. Empty bottles rolled from port to starboard and back with the swell. I stumbled upon an insensible Raphael curled around the windlass, his corrupted hand gripping his empty pewter. His bare young chest was bespattered by ochreous smearages. That the boy had found his solace in drink instead of his friend in Christ made my own spirits glummer. "Guilty thoughts disturbing your rest, Mr. Ewing," spoke a succubus at my shoulder, and I dropped my pipe. It was Boerhaave. I assured the Hollander that while my conscience was quite untroubled, I doubted he could claim as much. Boerhaave spat overboard, smiling. Had fangs and horns sprouted, I should have felt no surprise. He slung Raphael over his shoulder, slapped the sleeping prentice's buttocks, and carried his somnolent burden to the after-hatch. To keep him out of harm's way, I trust. Boxing Day. Yesterday's entry sentences me to a prison of remorse for the rest of my days. How perversely it reads, how flippant I was. Oh, I am sick to write these words. Raphael has hanged himself. Hanged by means of a noose slung over the mainmast lower yardarm. He ascended his gallows between the end of his watch and first bell. Fate decreed I should be amongst his discoverers. I was leaning over the bulwark, for the worm causes bouts of nausea as it is expelled. In the blue half-light I heard a cry and saw Mr. Roderick gazing heavenward. Confusion twisted his face, succeeded by disbelief, folding in grief. His lips formed a word, yet no word issued. He pointed to that he could not name. There swung a body, a gray form brushing the canvas. Noise erupted from all quarters, but who was shouting what to whom I cannot recall. Raphael, hanged, steady as a plumb lead as the prophetess pitched and rolled. That amiable boy, lifeless as a sheep on a butcher's hook. Atua had scrambled aloft, but all he could do was lower the boy down gently. I heard Guernsey mutter, "Should never have sailed on Friday. Friday's the Jonah." My mind burns with the question, why? None will discuss it, but Henry, who is as horrified as myself, told me that secretly Bentnail had intimated to him that the unnatural crimes of Sodom were visited upon the boy by Boerhaave and his garter snakes. Not just on Christmas night, but every night for many weeks. My duty is to follow this dark river to its source and impose justice on the miscreants, but, Lord, I can scarce sit up to feed myself. Henry says I cannot flagellate myself whene'er innocence falls prey to savagery, but how can I let this be? Raphael was Jackson's age. I feel such impotence,
I cannot bear it.
Friday, the 27th of December. Whilst Henry was called away to attend an injury, I hauled myself to Captain Molyneux's cabin to speak my mind. He was displeased at being visited, but I would not quit his quarters until my charge was stated. To wit, Boerhaave's pack had tormented Raphael with nightly bestiality until the boy, seeing no possibility of reprieve or relief, took his life. Finally, the captain asked, "You do, of course, have evidence for this crime? A suicide letter? Signed testimonials?" Every man aboard knew I spoke the truth. The captain could not be insensible of Boerhaave's brutality. I demanded an inquiry into the first mate's part in Raphael's self-slaughter. "Demand all you wish, Mr. Quillcock," Captain Molyneux shouted. "I decide who sails prophetess, who maintains discipline, who trains the prentices. Not a damned pen-pusher, not his damned ravings, and by God's blood, not any damned inquiry. Get out, sir, and blast you." I did so, and immediately collided with Boerhaave. I asked him if he was going to lock me up in his cabin with his garter snakes, then hope I'd hang myself before dawn. He showed his fangs, and in a voice laden with venom and hatred, issued this warning. "The stink of decay is on you, Quillcock. No man of mine would touch you lest he contract it. You'll die soon of your low fever." Notaries of the United States, I had the wit to warn him, do not vanish as conveniently as colonial cabin boys. I believe he entertained the notion of strangling me. But I am too sickly to be afraid of a Dutch sodomite. Later. Doubt besieges my conscience, and complicity is its charge. Did I give Raphael the permission he sought to commit self-slaughter? Had I divined his misery when last he spoke to me, interpreted his intention, and replied, "No, Raphael, the Lord cannot forgive a planned suicide, for repentance cannot be true if it occurs before the crime," the boy may yet be drawing breath. Henry insists I could not have known, but for once his words ring hollow to my ears. Oh, did I send that poor innocent to hell? Saturday, the 28th of December. A magic lantern show in my mind has the boy taking the rope, ascending the mast, knotting his noose, steadying himself, addressing his maker, launching himself into vacancy. As he rushed through the black, did he feel serenity or dread? The snap of his neck. Had I but known, I could have helped the child jump ship, deflect his destiny as the Channings did mine, or help him understand that no state of tyranny reigns forever. The prophetess has every inch of canvas aloft and is sailing like a witch, not for any benefit of mine, but because the cargo is rotting and makes over 3 degrees of latitude daily. I am terribly sick now and confined to my coffin. I suppose Boerhaave believes I am hiding from him. He is deceived, for the righteous vengeance I wish to visit upon his head is one of the few flames unextinguished by this dreadful torpor. Henry beseeches me write my journal to occupy my brain, but my pen grows unwieldy and heavy. We make Honolulu in 3 days. My loyal doctor promises to accompany me ashore, spare no expense to obtain powerful paregenics, and remain at my bedside until my recovery is complete, even if the prophetess must leave for California without us. God bless this best of men. I can write no more today. Sunday, the 29th of December. I fare most ill. Monday, the 30th of December. The worm is recrudescent. Its poison sacs have burst. I am racked with pain and bed sores and a dreadful thirst. Oahu is still 2 or 3 days to the north. Death is hours away. I cannot drink and do not recall when I ate last. I made Henry promise to deliver this journal to Bedford's in Honolulu. From there it will reach my bereaved family. He swears I shall deliver it on my own 2 feet, but my hopes are blasted. Henry has done his valiant best, but my parasite is too virulent, and I must entrust my soul to its maker. Jackson, when you are a grown man, do not permit your profession to sunder you from loved ones. During my months away from home, I thought of you and your mother with constant fondness, and should it come to pass... Footnote. Here my father's handwriting slips into spasmodic illegibility. J.E. Sunday, 12th January. The temptation to begin at the perfidious end is strong, but this diarist shall remain true to chronology. On New Year's Day, my head pains were rolling so thunderously I was taking Goose's medicine every hour. I could not stand against the ship's roll, so I stayed abed in my coffin, vomiting into a sack though my guts were vacant and shivering with an icy, scalding fever. My ailment could no longer be concealed from the crew, and my coffin was placed under quarantine. Goose had told Captain Molyneux that my parasite was contagious, thereby appearing the very paragon of selfless courage. The complicity of Captain Molyneux and Boerhaave in the subsequent malfeasance cannot be proven or disproven. Boerhaave wished evil on me, but I am forced to admit it unlikely he was party to the crime described below. I recall surfacing from feverish shallows. Goose was an inch away. His voice sank to a loving whisper. "Dearest Ewing, your worm is in its death throes and expelling every last drop of its poison. You must drink this purgative to expel its calcified remains. It will send you to sleep, but when you awake, the worm that has so tormented you shall be out. The end of your suffering is at hand. Open your mouth one last time. Handsomely does it, dearest of fellows. Here, 'tis bitter and foul a flavor. It's the myrrh, but down with it, for Tilda and Jackson." A glass touched my lips, and Goose's hand cradled my head. I tried to thank him. The potion tasted of bilge water and almond. Goose raised my head and stroked my Adam's apple until I swallowed the liquid. Time passed, I know not how long. The creaking of my bones and the ship's timbers were one. Somebody knocked. Light softened my coffin's darkness, and I heard Goose's voice from the corridor. "Yes, much, much better, Mr. Green. Yes, the worst is over. I was very worried, I confess, but Mr. Ewing's color is returning and his pulse strong." "Only 1 hour? Excellent news." "No, no, he's asleep now. Tell the captain we'll be going ashore tonight. If he could send word to arrange lodgings, I know Mr. Ewing's father-in-law will remember the kindness." Goose's face floated into my vision again. "Adam?" Another fist knocked at the door. Goose uttered an oath and swam away. I could no longer move my head but heard Otua demanding, "I see Mr. Ewing." Goose bade him be gone, but the tenacious Indian was not to be faced down so easily. "No. Mr. Green say he better. Mr. Ewing save my life. He my duty." Goose then told Otua this, that I saw in Otua a carrier of disease and a rogue planning to exploit my present infirmity to rob me even of the buttons for my waistcoat. I had begged Goose, so he claimed, to keep that damned nigger away from me, adding that I regretted ever saving his worthless neck. With that, Goose slammed and bolted my coffin door. Why had Goose lied so? Why was he so determined no one else should see me? The answer raised the latch on a door of deception, and an horrific truth kicked that same door in. To wit, the doctor was a poisoner and I his prey. Since the commencement of my treatment, the doctor had been killing me by degrees with his cure. My worm? A fiction, implanted by the doctor's power of suggestion. Goose? A doctor? No. An itinerant, murdering, confidence trickster. I fought to rise, but the evil liquid my succubus had lately fed me had enfeebled my limbs so wholly I could not so much as twitch my extremities. I tried to shout for aid, but my lungs did not inflate. I heard Artua's footsteps retreat up the companionway and prayed for God to guide him back, but his intentions were otherwise. Goose clambered up the hawser to my bunk. He saw my eyes. Seeing my fear, the demon removed his mask.
"What's that you're saying, Ewing? How shall I comprehend if you drool and dribble so?"
I emitted a frail whine.
"Let me guess what you're trying to tell me." "Oh, Henry, we were friends, Henry. How could you do this to me?"
He mimicked my hoarse, dying whisper.
"Am I on the nose?"
Goose cut the key from my neck and spoke as he worked at uncovering my trunk.
"Surgeons are a singular brotherhood, Adam. To us, people aren't sacred beings crafted in the Almighty's image, no. People are joints of meat. Diseased, leathery meat, yes, but meat ready for the skewer and the spit."
He mimicked my usual voice very well.
"But why me, Henry? Are we not friends?"
"Well, Adam, even friends are made of meat."
"'Tis absurdly simple. I need money, and in your trunk, I am told, is an entire estate. So I have killed you for it. Where is the mystery?" "But, Henry, this is wicked."
"But, Adam, the world is wicked.
Maoris prey on Moriori. Whites prey on darker-hued cousins. Fleas prey on mice. Cats prey on rats. Christians on infidels. First mates on cabin boys, death on the living.
The weak are meat, the strong do eat." Goose checked my eyes for sentience and kissed my lips.
"Your turn to be eaten, dear Adam. You are no more gullible than any other of my patrons."
My trunk lid swung open. Goose counted through my pocketbook, sneered, found the emerald from Von Wies and examined it through an eyepiece. He was unimpressed. The fiend untied the bundles of documents relating to the Busby estate and tore open the sealed envelopes in search of banknotes. I heard him count my modest supply. He tapped my trunk for secret compartments, but he found none, for there are none. Lastly, he snipped the buttons from my waistcoat. Goose addressed me through my delirium as one might address an unsatisfactory tool. "Frankly, I am disappointed. I have known Irish navvies with more pounds to their name. Your cash scarcely covers my arsenic and opiate. If Mrs. Horrocks had not donated her hoard of black pearls to my worthy cause, poor Goose's goose would be basted and cooked. Well, it is time for us to part. You will be dead within the hour, and for me, 'tis hey-ho for the open road." My next cogent remembrance is of drowning in salt water so bright it hurt. Had Boerhaave found my body and thrown me overboard to ensure my silence and avoid tiresome procedures with the American consul? My mind was still active and as such might yet exercise some say in my destiny. Consent to drown or attempt to swim? Drowning was by far the least troublesome option, so I cast about for a dying thought and settled on Tilda, waving off the Belle Hoxie from Silvaplana Wharf so many months before, with Jackson shouting, "Papa, bring me back a kangaroo's paw." The thought of never more seeing them was so distressing, I elected to swim and found myself not in the sea but curled on deck. Vomiting profusely and trembling violently with fever, aches, cramps, pinches. Atua was holding me. He had forced a bucketful of brine down me to flush out the poison. I retched and retched. Boerhaave shoved his way through the crowd of onlooking stevedores and seamen, snarling, "I told you once, nigger, that Yankee's no concern of yours, and if a direct order won't convince you..." Though the sun half-blinded me, I saw the first mate land one brutal kick in Atua's ribs and launch another. Atua gripped the atrabilious Hollander's shin in one firm hand whilst he gently lowered my head to the deck and rose up to his full height, taking his assailant's leg with him, robbing Boerhaave of his balance. The Dutchman fell on his head with a leonine roar. Atua now seized the other foot and slung our first mate over the bulwarks like a sack of cabbages. Whether the crewmen were too fearful, astonished, or delighted to offer any resistance, I shall never know, but Atua carried me down a gangplank on the dockside unmolested. My reason informed me that Boerhaave could not be in heaven nor Atua in hell, so we must be in Honolulu. From the harbor we passed down a thoroughfare bustling with innumerable tongues, hues, creeds, and odors. My eyes met a Chinaman's as he rested beneath a carved dragon. A pair of women whose paint and tournure advertised their ancient calling peered at me and crossed themselves. I tried to tell them I was not yet dead, but they were gone. Atua's heart beat against my side, encouraging my own. Thrice he asked of strangers, "Where doctor, friend?" Thrice he was ignored. One answered, "No medicine for stinking blacks," before an old fish seller grunted directions to a sick house. I was parted from my senses for a time before hearing the word infirmary. Merely entering its fetid air, laden with ordure and decomposition, caused me to retch anew, notwithstanding my stomach was empty as a discarded glove. The buzzing of bluebottles hovered, and a madman howled about Jesus adrift on the Sargasso Sea. Atua muttered to himself in his own tongue. "Patience more, Mr. Ewing. This place smelled death. I take you to sisters." How Atua's sisters might have strayed so far from Chatham Isle was a puzzle I could not begin to solve, but I entrusted myself to his care. He quitted that charnel house, and soon the taverns, dwellings, and warehouses thinned before giving way to sugar plantations. I knew I should ask or warn Atua about Goose, but speech was yet beyond my powers. Nauseous slumber tightened, then loosened its grip on me. A distinct hill rose up, and its name stirred in memory's sediment, Diamond Head. The road hither was rocks, dust, and holes, walled on both sides with unyielding vegetation. Atua's stride broke only once, to cup cool stream water to my lips, until we arrived at a Catholic mission, beyond the final fields. A nun tried to shoo us away with a broom, but Atua enjoined her, in Spanish as broken as his English, to grant his white charge sanctuary. Finally, one sister who evidently knew Atua arrived and persuaded the others that the savage was on a mission not of malice, but of mercy. By the third day I could sit up, feed myself, Thank my guardian angels and Atua, the last free Moriori in this world, for my deliverance. Atua insists that had I not prevented him from being tossed overboard as a stowaway, he could not have saved me, and so, in a sense, it is not Atua who has preserved my life, but myself. Be that as it may, no nursemaid ever ministered as tenderly as rope-roughened Atua has to my sundry needs these last 10 days. Sister Veronique of the Broom jests that my friend should be ordained and appointed hospital director. Mentioning neither Henry Goose, or the poisoner who assumed that name, nor the saltwater bath which Atua gave Borhoffa, Captain Molyneux forwarded my effects via Bedford's agent, doubtless with one eye on the mischief my father-in-law may inflict on his future as a trader operating from San Francisco. Molyneux's other eye is on disassociating his reputation from that now notorious murderer known as the Arsenic Goose. The devil has not yet been apprehended by the port constabulary, nor, I suspect, shall that day ever come. In Honolulu's lawless hive, where vessels of all flags and nations arrive and depart daily, a man may change his name and history between entree and dessert. I am exhausted and must rest. Today is my 34th birthday. I remain thankful to God for all his mercies. Monday, the 13th of January. Sitting under the candle-nut tree in the courtyard is pleasant in the afternoon. Laced shadows, frangipani, and coral hibiscus ward away the memory of recent evil. The sisters go about their duties. Sister Martinique tends her vegetables. The cats enact their feline comedies and tragedies. I am making acquaintances amongst the local avifauna. The palila has a head and tail of burnished gold. The ekoekohe is a handsome crested honeycreeper. Over the wall is a poorhouse for foundlings, also administered by the sisters. I hear the children chanting their classes, just as my schoolmates and I used to before Mr. and Mrs. Channing's philanthropy elevated my prospects. After their studies are done, the children conduct their play in a beguiling babble. Sometimes the more daring of their number brave the nun's displeasure by scaling the wall and conduct a grand tour above the hospice garden by means of the candle-nut's obliging branches. If the coast is clear, the pioneers beckon their more timid playmates onto this human aviary, and white faces, brown faces, Kanaka faces, Chinese faces, mulatto faces appear in the arboreal overworld. Some are Raphael's age, and when I remember him, a bile of remorse rises in my throat. But the orphans grin down at me, imitate monkeys, poke out their tongues, or try to drop kuikui nuts into the mouths of snoring convalescents, and do not let me stay mournful for very long. They beg me for a cent or two. I toss up a coin for dexterous fingers to pluck unerringly from the air. My recent adventures have made me quite the philosopher, especially at night, when I hear naught but the stream grinding boulders into pebbles through an unhurried eternity. My thoughts flow thus. Scholars discern motions in history and formulate these motions into rules that govern the rises and falls of civilizations. My belief runs contrary, however. To wit, history admits no rules, only outcomes. What precipitates outcomes? Vicious acts and virtuous acts. What precipitates acts? Belief. Belief is both prize and battlefield within the mind and in the mind's mirror, the world. If we believe humanity is a ladder of tribes, a coliseum of confrontation, exploitation, and bestiality, such a humanity is surely brought into being. and history's Horrockses, Boerhoffes, and Gooses shall prevail. You and I, the moneyed, the privileged, the fortunate, shall not fare so badly in this world, provided our luck holds. What of it if our consciences itch? Why undermine the dominance of our race, our gunships, our heritage, and our legacy? Why fight the natural, oh, weaselly word, order of things? Why? Because of this. One fine day, a purely predatory world shall consume itself. Yes, the devil shall take the hindmost until the foremost is the hindmost. In an individual, selfishness uglifies the soul. For the human species, selfishness is extinction. Is this the doom written within our nature? If we believe that humanity may transcend tooth and claw, if we believe diverse races and creeds can share this world as peaceably as the orphans share their candlenut tree, if we believe leaders must be just, violence muzzled, power accountable, and the riches of the earth and its oceans shared equitably, such a world will come to pass. I am not deceived. It is the hardest of worlds to make real. Torturous advances won over generations can be lost by a single stroke of a myopic president's pen or a vainglorious general's sword. A life spent shaping a world I want Jackson to inherit, not one I fear Jackson shall inherit, this strikes me as a life worth the living. Upon my return to San Francisco, I shall pledge myself to the abolitionist cause because I owe my life to a self-freed slave and because I must begin somewhere. I hear my father-in-law's response. Oh, oh, fine. Whiggish sentiments, Adam. But don't tell me about justice. Ride to Tennessee on an ass and convince the rednecks that they are merely whitewashed Negroes, and their Negroes are blackwashed whites. Sail to the old world. Tell them their imperial slaves' rights are as inalienable as the Queen of Belgium's. Oh, you'll grow hoarse, poor, and gray in caucuses. You'll be spat on, shot at, lynched, pacified with medals, spurned by backwoodsmen, crucified. Naive, dreaming Adam, he who would do battle with the many-headed hydra of human nature must pay a world of pain, and his family must pay it along with him. And only as you gasp your dying breath shall you understand your life amounted to no more than one drop in a limitless ocean. Yet what is any ocean but a multitude of drops? We hope you've enjoyed this production of Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.